Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And here is one indication of how many people will be watching tonight's debate. It's ESPN's if you can't beat them, join them approach. They're not even trying to convince people to watch Monday Night Football instead of the debate. Rather, they're running a promo suggesting that football fans watch both at the same time. The idea is that you can watch the debate on your TV and the game on your phone as a second screen. They're doing this with the knowledge that obviously people are looking at our phones at the same time as our TVs are on a lot. But it's a rare form of network surrender, wouldn't you say, to advertise your product for while people are watching something else. And this may scare you as much as it surprises you, but the Washington Post and ABC News find in their new poll that the number of Americans who say they might be swayed by the debate into choosing one candidate or the other is larger than the difference between the candidates in the poll. The ABC News Washington Post poll that came out yesterday has Clinton and Trump basically tied for the national popular vote, while 17% of registered voters said the debate could change their minds, and 6% said there's a good chance of that occurring. So what happens tonight has the potential to matter a lot. So if you are watching football at the same time, please pay enough attention to the debate to figure out who you would like as, let's say, your first round draft pick for quarterback of the free world, if that language helps. And listeners, our phones are open for you to tell us what you will be watching for tonight. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we're asking this seriously. We're also going to be collecting tweets on this all day in advance of the pregame special that I will be hosting tonight, to use ESPN lingo, at 8 o'clock before the 9 o'clock debate here on WNYC. We want to know what you'll be watching for. So if you already decided, what will you be watching for? And if you're undecided, what will you be watching for? Tweet at Brian Lehrer or call in with that right now at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we get some first thoughts on this debate day from New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd. Her new collection of columns about Clinton and Trump from over the years is called The Year of Voting Dangerously. Dowd won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary in 1999 for her columns during the year of Bill Clinton's impeachment, 98. She's also the author of two previous books, Bush World, Enter at Your Own Risk, published in 2004, and Are Men Necessary When Sexes Collide, published in 2005. Hi, Maureen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Let me start with one of your columns from last year, as maybe representative of a bigger thing out there in the country. After the first Republican primary debate in August, in which Megyn Kelly challenged Trump on his history of sexist comments, you kind of defended Trump. But then after the column ran, you ran a postscript.
Right.
I guess because you were horrified at the degree of sexism Trump engaged in when criticizing Megyn Kelly after the fact. Can you go back to that and describe what you first thought and led you to that, I think, rare act for a columnist, a postscript kind of tweaking your own opinion?
Right. Well, I think with everyone, my siblings have written two essays for the book, my conservative siblings, about voting for Trump and or trying to. And, you know, you can almost see what Paul Ryan thinks when you read their essays, because he can't say it, but there's a lot of agonizing every time Trump does something appalling. You know, my sister will jump off the Trump train, and then she'll realize, you know, she doesn't want Hillary Clinton as president or Hillary Clinton Supreme Court, so she jumps back on, then he says something appalling, and she jumps off. So I think that is the dynamic. After the Kahn debacle at the Democratic convention, when
Kaiser Kahn, the Gold Star,
when he dissed the Gold Star family, my brother called me and said, "Can I kill my essay?" And I'm like, "No, the book is already shipped." So I think this, it gives you insight into you know, this tumultuous ride that people are on with these the two of the most unfavorable candidates in political history.
So do you think you have a focus group of two in your own siblings on why the Trump numbers seem to go from significantly behind Hillary Clinton, that some people just a few weeks ago were saying this could be a blowout, an epic blowout, to close again, and then it falls back again, and then close again?
Well, I know that, you know, Hillary's supporters are very shocked and upset, you know, and they keep insisting that they wanted the moderator tonight to point out if Trump lies, and they want, you know, the press to point it out, and the Times has changed its policy on that. You know, for the first time, they are calling a candidate a liar or talking about his big whoppers. And I wish they had had this policy in place when I was covering the buildup to the Iraq War and Dick Cheney, because I was constantly looking up synonyms for liar with Cheney.
You made that comparison, Trump and Cheney, if I'm remembering correctly, in a column in August, didn't you?
Yeah. Yes. Well, Cheney, you know, yes, because what Republicans want is a more subtle form of racism in their nominee. And with Cheney, they wanted a more subtle form. They were willing to accept a more subtle form of crazy. But Trump, you know, it's all out there, like Madonna wearing her underwear on the outside.
So now that we've gotten to Madonna wearing her underwear on the outside, listeners, why will you be watching the debate, even if you're not expecting to see anything like that? 212-433-WNYC, as we talk to Maureen Dowd, New York Times columnist and author of the book now, The Year of Voting Dangerously. And let's start with Mary Beth in Brooklyn. Mary Beth, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to vote for Hillary, and I decided that long ago, but I'm watching the debate because I'm very, very concerned. I myself am not the greatest public speaker, and she's not. And I'm worried she's going to come across as aloof or overly detailed or not personable. And I'm similarly worried that Mr. Trump will move the needle in his direction by his stage tricks and...
And that she won't, and Lester Holt, the moderator, won't sufficiently call him out on those?
Well, yeah, I think even if the moderator calls him out, he perhaps doesn't have the attention span to actually follow through on anything, but I think if the moderator calls him out, he'll just distract back to something that he can do that's funny or a soundbite or outrageous that will steal the show.
Mary Beth, thank you for your call. And Maureen, I think she speaks for a lot of Clinton supporters in what they're worried about, both on Clinton's side and on Trump's side. Having covered Hillary Clinton for as long as you have, how do you see that tension for her?
First I'd like to say I totally identify with you because I'm terrified of public speaking too. You know, in a way, it's like Freaky Friday because they each have to get some of the other's qualities. Like she's seen as too tightly controlled and he's sort of seen as out of control. So he has to bring some of her measured tone and she has to elicit some of the excitement around him. And, you know, she's been working with psychologists and Tony Schwartz, who co-wrote The Art of the Deal, to try and figure out how to, I think the dynamic that she's trying for is like in A Few Good Men when Tom Cruise is questioning Jack Nicholson and Jack Nicholson suddenly loses it because Tom Cruise is, you know, taunting him and he can't take it. So, and then he begins saying, "You want me on that wall." So she wants to get Trump to say, "You want me building that wall," you know, and just kind of lose it. And then from his point of view, he probably wants to continue the alt-right conspiracy about her health. So he might, you know, try to help her up to the stage or make her seem somehow weak or come out, you know, shake hands and then have his big industrial strength bottle of Purell. So they're, you know, and but the hilarious thing is the way the contrast in their personalities as they prepare, because she's the queen of homework and he's the king of winging it. So she has been going over Arcania and, you know, with these binders of briefing books, and she had, you know, rushed back to do an 11 p.m. rehearsal or whatever, or more studying after she met with some world leaders this week. So, and he, on the other hand, was with Roger Ailes, you know, at his golf club, drinking Cokes and eating cheeseburgers and thinking up zingers. And then he, you know, his team tried to get him to look at tapes of himself, you know, in the primary debate, so that he could see his weaknesses and work on them. But when he looked at the tapes of himself, he thought he was amazingly great.
What else is new?
Yeah, exactly.
DK in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hi, DK.
Hi, yes. I'm looking to see if I can find some fact-checking, because I think that's vital. And there's something I want to mention, especially since I have Maureen Dowd here listening. I find there's a piece I read this morning on pressthink.org about asymmetry between major parties as the circuit of the mainstream media. Basically, you guys are reporting on Trump and Clinton like if they're equals. I think that's a huge disservice to the public. Trump is not the equal of Clinton. The Democrats are not the equal of the Republicans in terms of, I would say, constitutional efficacy, and in terms of, I would say, a functional democracy, on what part they take in a functional democracy. The Republicans have gone way off the rails. I'm a registered independent. I'm neither for a Republican or a Democrat, right? I wasn't particularly enamored with Hillary in the primary. I was more with Bernie. But as far as I can see things, since Barack Obama got elected, the Republicans have lost their collective brown stuff, if I want to say. Right? That's all I have to say.
DK,
Republicans,
thanks.
You have lost your collective brown stuff, and you guys are just off the rails. I mean, you guys are off the rails. For any objective observer, right? It's not even a hard choice.
DK, thank you so much. Well, I've heard people say they've lost their collective gray matter. Now we have another color reference from DK. But of course, he raises a very serious question, and one that is very prevalent right now.
Well, I think the press has had a hard time getting its arms around this race, because I use the analogy that it's like Who Killed Jessica Rabbit? So it's a tune, you know, dealing with a human. And so the press is trying to treat them both like
That's
humans.
That's a cartoon, not a song.
Yes, a cartoon.
A T-O-O-N.
So Trump was like a sort of a Batman, you know, villain cartoon in New York, this larger-than-life kind of crazy persona, and he does all these things we've never seen. All the usual metrics of politics are thrown out about money and message and, you know, lying. And so sometimes we get it right, like the Times has grappled with this and now just calls his big fat whoppers. But other times the press is still struggling. For instance, Trump came to the open his Washington hotel in the old post office last week, and he said he was going to make an announcement about the birther issue. So the press went, and MSNBC had the camera on the podium for an hour and a half, and then Trump like spent 10 seconds at the end, you know, on the birther thing, and the press said they felt played and he made suckers of them. But if the press doesn't know by now that he was inviting them there to make an infomercial about his hotel, then they need to read my book.
Well, how do you feel about your own work in the context of the caller's question? The Year of Voting Dangerously, Maureen Dowd's new book, a collection of her columns about both Clinton and Trump. You know, in the context of this big media discussion right now about false equivalencies, Clinton, who has her major flaws to be sure, but Trump, who the questions to ask about him are whether he's a unique threat to the country among major presidential candidates in modern times. How do you deal with the false equivalency question for yourself as you look back at your work on the two of them and for the media at large?
Well, I understand how people feel, because my own friends would not read my interviews with Trump. You know, they just wouldn't. They acted kind of distant about reading any words he spoke. But
always, or just since he's been running for president?
Since he's been running for president. But, you know, I kind of agree with Matt Taibbi and Rolling Stone that some of the people yelling about false equivalency just want censorship. They just want a total news blackout on Trump. And I just don't believe in that. And they want everybody to give Hillary Clinton a free pass because they think this is too dangerous a moment. But, you know, I'm not an ideological columnist. My column doesn't come from the left or the right. It's about how power warps people and, you know, or how they rise to the occasion. And it's more sort of based on Shakespeare. So for me, I don't think anyone seeking the job of the most powerful person on earth can be given a free pass. It's not good for her. It's not good for us. It's not good for democracy. So I think she has to be examined as well. And I think it's clear, for instance, there's so much self-flagellation in the press now, but look at the Times coverage, but also David Fahrenthold in the Washington Post, who I hope we'll get a Pulitzer. You know, he's done amazing work on the Trump Foundation and Trump's, you know, the corruption in his foundation. So I think the press is making it clear that his foundation issues are worse than hers, but it sort of limits her ability to attack him because she does have, like, blurred lines in her foundation.
Actually, let me change. Go back and move. So in that context, I want to play a clip of Clinton campaign manager Robbie Mook on CNN yesterday, and then one of Trump's running mate, Governor Mike Pence, being challenged by Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday, and get your reactions to exactly the point you were just making, or the points. Here is Mook with a popular Democratic thought going into this debate.
I'm very concerned that Donald Trump will be graded on the on a curve. Just because he doesn't fly off the handle in the middle of this debate does not mean that he is prepared to be president of the United States.
So the idea of grading on a curve, very much in the popular conversation right now from the Democratic side, and obviously he's a partisan of the candidate, it's aimed somewhat at the moderator, but also, I guess, aimed at public perception in general.
But I think that a lot of Hillary supporters and her campaign can't accept the fact that, you know, Trump is moving ahead. But Trump voters, you know, have accepted the things about Trump that they are so outraged about because they want to use him as a baseball bat to destroy Washington. In a way, I think, you know, there were so many nihilists like Ted Cruz wanting to burn down the Capitol he worked in and, you know, nothing getting done, and the Republican obstructionists, and then they didn't keep any of their promises to their voters. And I think, in a way, it's turned the voters into nihilists. I mean, I keep seeing quotes from Trump voters saying, you know, the reporter will say, "Don't you think he's dangerous?" And they'll say, "I don't care. You know, I just want to take that baseball bat and smash Washington."
And so here's the Chris Wallace-Mike Pence exchange. It's the whole thing is longer than this excerpt, but as it is, we pulled a minute and a half of it to make the point that Wallace was really grilling Pence on this Washington Post David Fahrenthold revelation that Trump used $25,000 of Trump Foundation money to help fund his own legal bills, which could be against the law.
Let me ask you about one specific case, and that is the case of the flag in Mar-a-Lago. The city of Palm Beach sued Mar-a-Lago because they had a flag that exceeded zoning barriers. There was a settlement under which Mar-a-Lago, the for-profit club run by Donald Trump, was going to pay $100,000 to a charity. Number one, he didn't pay it. The club didn't pay it. The foundation paid it. And secondly, Donald Trump hasn't contributed a dime to his own foundation since 2008. What kind of a charity is that, sir?
Well, I know that the Trump Foundation, the family, can answer all of those questions about that specific instance and others, and they have. I think the American people are even more interested.
They haven't. They have not explained. They have not explained, sir. The Washington Post has asked them. They have not explained how it was the foundation that it ended up spending money instead of either Trump or Mar-a-Lago. They also haven't explained why he hasn't contributed any money since 2008.
Well, look, these answers are all fair game, Chris, but I just wish there was as much interest in the activities of the Clinton Foundation that we know accepted tens of millions of dollars from foreign countries and foreign donors who were then given access to Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State.
So Mike Pence didn't deny any of that. He just tried to deflect attention back to Clinton. Mike Pence with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. If you're just joining us, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd with us now. Her new book, with some new material and many of her past columns about both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, is called The Year of Voting Dangerously. And one thing that strikes me about that exchange is that for a moderator who's made news by saying he will not fact check during the debate that he's going to moderate next month, he was doing it there. What do you think about the best role for the moderator to play in these debates? And do you think Chris Wallace will not be as specific in his fact checks when he moderates the later debate as he was on his own show yesterday?
Well, it's funny. But there are a couple other examples from the Trump Foundation where he used the money to buy like some 12-foot portrait of himself and then to settle a lawsuit about some guy who didn't get paid after a hole-in-one contest, you know, at one of the golf courses. But, yeah, it's pretty absurd. I really respect Chris Wallace. I think he does an excellent, fair job. And, you know, personally, I'd like to see the candidates just ask each other questions. I wish there didn't have to be a moderator at all.
That's what Trump has said.
Yeah, I agree with it. It's
Lincoln-Douglas debate
style. It's kind of like even on Meet the Press, it's really just the press talking to each other. It's not the press grilling the politician anymore. I would like Lincoln-Douglas style. I think that would be interesting.
Maybe they'll have one of those portions of the debate, as they sometimes do, where one candidate gets to ask the other candidate a question, and then vice versa.
Right. I think that maybe a lesson was learned on the Matt Lauer Commander-in-Chief Forum, because NBC was thinking of that as like a showcase for Matt Lauer. And you can't do that in this election. You've got to have people who can fact check in their head in real time. So you've got to have a Chris Wallace or a Chuck Todd or an Andrea Mitchell or a Jake Tapper.
Right. And I was actually questioning, I said this on the show last week, the choice of Lester Holt, not that there's anything wrong with him as, you know, anchor of the NBC Nightly News, but he doesn't have the kind of experience to do that live, complicated moderation conversation that the people who you mentioned, and you could go to some of the PBS people like Gwen Ifill, who's been so great at it.
Yes, she's wonderful.
And has never gotten a presidential debate, only a vice presidential debate. It was a curious choice in a way.
Yeah, I would have liked to see Gwen, but she's a friend of mine, so I was rooting for her. But I agree. I think I'm sure Lester Holt, is studying and will, he's a respected newsman. I guess I just think in this uniquely, because of what, the last caller said, in this race, you have to have people who are really baked and sautéed in every nuance so that you can challenge Donald Trump in real time.
Robert in Valley Stream, you're on WNYC. As we keep taking calls, and we'll take tweets all day, folks, leading up to the debate and the 1 hour before the debate coverage that I'll be hosting at 8 o'clock tonight here on the station. We'll be taking tweets all day on why you'll be watching, whether you've made up your mind or not. And we're taking some calls on that now. And Robert in Valley Stream is next. Hey, Robert, thanks for holding on.
Yes, I'll be watching for which candidate veers more towards the center. When they are in the primaries, they usually play to their constituents. And now that it's getting closer to the elections, then they tend to veer more to the center. And I'm looking for that.
Is there a particular issue or two that you would name for each of them that you want them to be more centrist on?
Yes. I'm worried about Trump about not fixing the Supreme Court, putting in another very Scalia kind of a person. Mm-hmm. And it's from Hillary. She said that she no boots on the ground. She's giving a free pass to Putin and Erdogan to keep on their fascistic dictatorial path.
That's Clinton, who's too close to Putin, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yes. Clinton, yes.
Robert, thank you very much.
Well, you know, that's what's so another confusing thing about this year and weird thing is that Hillary, in many ways, you know, is the GOP establishment candidate, and she is the candidate of Goldman Sachs, and we did a big story on that the other day that was excellent about how cozy her ties to Goldman Sachs are, where Donald Trump is cozying up to the evil empire. So everything is all jumbled up in this campaign. And in the debate, you'll see it again because Trump will probably accuse her of, you know, helping to get us into the Iraq war, where so he'll seem like the dove in some weird ways and she'll seem like the hawk.
And that was probably the most developed part of that Times article over the weekend that you referred to, a week of whoppers from Donald Trump, where they counted 31 lies, and there were some Clinton lies that they documented too. But it's interesting, the Times, the Washington Post, and Politico all had articles like this over the last few days.
Yeah.
Saying basically, yeah, Clinton lies too, but she lies kind of like an ordinary politician.
She lies like a lawyer.
And Trump tells these whoppers that are made up of whole cloth, and, you know, qualitatively they're different in that respect, as well as quantitatively. And they were going into some detail. A number of these had to do with Trump saying that he was against going into the war in Iraq. Lie number two, this is not getting any truer with repetition, the Times wrote. He never publicly expressed opposition to the war before it began, and he made supportive remarks to Howard Stern. And then a follow-up on that, he said he had publicly opposed the war in Iraq in an Esquire interview, quote, pretty quickly after the war started. And the fact check is the Esquire interview appeared in the August 2004 edition, 17 months after the war began. And it goes on like that.
Well, in The Art of the Deal, he calls it truthful hyperbole. But it's beyond that. It's like sort of an alternative universe, which the Republicans had been heading for a while. I remember one time a W official during the height of, you know, when they thought they were riding high with the Iraq invasion, they referred to journalists as, quote unquote, the reality-based community, as though they could create their own alternative universe. And now Donald Trump has actually done it.
You know what I'm curious about from your lens, since you've known or covered both these candidates for such a long time? On Trump, you take us back in the book to at least 1999, when Trump first started thinking seriously about running for president, you say. What was the context of that for him at the time? Because many of his positions, Robert, our last caller, talks about interest in seeing him move toward the center, seeing them both move toward the center. But many of his positions were different. He was pro-choice. He knew who David Duke was and denounced him, denounced him without having his arm twisted.
Yeah.
Why did Trump think about running for president back then?
It's so funny because I went to with him to his first presidential rope line. So he was checking it out, and we went on his plane with all the fake French Impressionist paintings and the big bed and the gilt fixtures and the junk food. And
was that last summer? No, seriously.
No, 99.
Oh, that was a presidential exploration.
Yes, but a very brief one because he made a speech to Cuban Americans and got a good reception. And then we walked up to a rope line where they had signs that said Trump 2000. And he was very shy about it and sort of skittered away. And, you know, he just couldn't fathom it then, but I asked him, I said, why do you think people would vote for you? And he said, because I get high ratings on Larry King. So even then he had this ego arithmetic. And another reason he said was that a lot of men had hit on Melania. So everything was numbers, you know, the numbers that show that he's popular in the same way he still does that. You know, a lot of the issue questions, and you'll see it tonight, are answered with this ego arithmetic.
And so did he change into someone who puts Mexican and Muslim baiting at the heart of his ambition? Or is it pointless to even discuss his beliefs? And it's mostly about that aspect of his narcissism, finally getting into the driver's seat now that he's 70 years old.
Right.
And as they say in Hamilton, I'm not throwing away my shot.
Right. I asked him in this cycle, you know, a couple months ago, why he had... why the person I see on stage seems so different than the person I covered in New York, and more malignant, more bigoted. And he said, I guess, you know, he got to number one. He got past those 16 other Republicans because he started saying this stuff, and then he just didn't stop. But it seems like, you know, he's an attention addict, so he's following the roar of the crowd. Unfortunately, he's gotten, you know, on a boat there down the river that to a lot of really dark places following the roar of the crowd.
One more call for Maureen Dowd. Steve in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I am a journalist and also the son of a police officer like Maureen, and all of my relatives, not all of them, but many of them are voting for Trump. And I speak to them and I ask them, like the rest of us journalists ask them, how could you possibly do this? But there are reasons for it, and the two principal ones are immigration and the loss of jobs. These have not been addressed by politicians. So there's not just this reality star, this crazy guy. There's actually two very good reasons, and of course, very strong dislike for Hillary, that my relatives are going to vote for him.
Can I ask if your relatives feel personally disadvantaged by immigration?
Yes.
Personally harmed? In what way?
Yes. Where they live, there's a sea of what they say. This is what they tell me. There's a sea of immigrants that are changing the dynamic of where they live, and not for the good, not in a good way. This is what I'm reporting, right?
Mm-hmm. And what does not in a good way mean? I'm just curious what that actually means.
Not in a good way. They're changing the very dynamic of how the neighborhood was, of where they live, the area where they live. You know what's going on Long Island, Brian. You've reported on it. There's some real issues there about overcrowding and housing. There's some real issues about all kinds of things that are happening with immigrants. This isn't the immigration thing. Isn't this pie in the sky great thing all the time? There's more people here than ever before, and that's affecting certain people in our society bad way.
Right. But I'm trying to hear your relatives' specifics as specifically as possible, because there's. You know, on the one hand, a kind of biased perception that, oh, the neighborhood is changing, the neighborhood is not what it was. Oh, those people live too many in a house without the individual who has those concerns being materially affected. And then so others say, oh, well, they just don't like those dark people.
Well, there's probably truth in that as well. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just telling you what they tell me.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand, I think journalists are missing a big part of this thing by simply dismissing a lot of this stuff. These are things that haven't been addressed by politicians on both sides. The loss of jobs overseas. Do you remember who won the primary in New Hampshire in 1996? Pat Buchanan. What did he win on? He won on jobs going overseas.
Well,
New Hampshire
lot,
was on the front lines of that.
And a
that
lot
was 20
of the
years ago.
White nationalism that Trump is echoing today. And the economists will debate whether trade is a net positive or a net negative. But, Steve, I hear you. The obvious, serious personal concerns that people have, and we're going to be talking next hour specifically about a lot of those folks with the sociologist Arlie Hochschild, who will be here. She's written a book about anger and mourning on the American right, and she puts it as much in terms of mourning as anger. But Maureen, what were you thinking as you listened to Steve, like you, son of a cop?
Yeah, I understand exactly what he's saying. I agree that the Republicans ignoring issues that people were really upset about, you know, is how Donald Trump rose, because the Republicans in Washington said they would fix immigration and said they would fix the budget and other things, and they didn't. And I would, you know, Trump voters often are dismissed. Some of my fellow columnists go out on these Margaret Mead anthropological editions, expeditions, and drive cross country and look for this rare, strange creature called the Trump voter, and I just have to go home. But I think voters, I mean, of course, there are some racist and sexist voters in here, but not my siblings. And a lot of voters are really angry because they trusted their leaders. And, you know, NAFTA didn't turn out to be the bright, shiny object that everyone insisted globalization was going to be. And we went to this war that now everyone agrees that we shouldn't have gone in. Well, maybe not everyone. I guess not Dick Cheney. But we went to this very costly and in human terms and money terms war that we shouldn't have been in. And most Americans don't even know who Sunnis and Shia are or why we were there. And then the economy almost collapsed, and most Americans didn't know what derivatives were. So they put a lot of trust in their leaders, and that trust has been abused over and over again. And that's why now a lot of them want a baseball bat.
Maureen Dowd, her new book is a collection of columns that she's written over time about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, plus new material. The book is called The Year of Voting Dangerously. That's voting dangerously. Maureen, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll review week one of the Bridgegate trial and preview week two. Not a boring week in court. Stay with us.